terms, do some summarizing for us. I think this is it helps with the history course to see what has gone on. And let me just trace over. We're coming now toward the end of this quarter, the end of this fourth section, the church in the later Middle Ages, leading us up to the Reformation. We have seen that for several centuries, in the early Christian centuries, the church grew stronger and stronger, more centrally organized, more powerful, owned more land, controlled more wealth, as the Roman Empire in the West and later on in the East disintegrated. In the East, the Muslims took much of it, took some sections in the West. And so in this effort to bring order out of chaos, the Dark Ages, there developed a great struggle between the church and the state. The church, you have dynasties, secular dynasties like the Frankish dynasties, the strong tribe, which, through what's called the Holy Roman Empire, trying to restore civil order. You have the church marching to the drumbeat of Augustine and his concept of the city of God, seeing it their task to establish and rule a Christian society. The question is, if it is a holy empire, if it is a holy society, if it is Christendom, who is in charge? And we, for a long time, the church was able to assert itself over the state. You recall that on Christmas Day in 800, when Charlemagne was crowned, but what happened with the church reached its high point. We say this last hour, the church reached the apex of its actual power, not its claims, but the apex of its actual power with Innocent III. But Innocent III, in his manipulation, in his political manipulations, he undermined the centralized authority what little there was in the Holy Roman Empire. He caused John of England to knuckle down, but the Pope sacrificed spiritual leadership for political power, and we're going to see now as the Roman Church becomes increasingly politicized, things begin to go the other way. What had happened in the earlier period was that the state was weaker than the church. Now this is all changing. Now we are having, and this leads us up to the Renaissance, the development of nations, the rise of nations as we know them. They begin to evolve. You begin to have kings who claim more and more centralized authority, and we're going to see the church less and less able to do what Innocent III did, and a few other popes to a lesser degree, that is to actually used to assert, to have the kind of control authority they claim. You see that? It's going the other way now. And we're going to study today, first of all, one phase of the history of the church which did as much, if not more than anything else, as much as, if not more than, any other thing to weaken the influence of the papacy. We're going to see at the end of today's discussion, the church has come a long way from the power of Innocent III. Who's decided who was going to rule where, such the power of Gregory, who would make Henry stand out in the snow at Canossa and beg forgiveness. It's all changing. And the event, the thing that hurt the Roman Catholic papacy more than anything else in this period, in my opinion, was what we call the Babylonian captivity of the church. You recall that the Pope, Innocent III, really cut his own throat, or cut the throat of the papacy, because when he successfully undermined the power of the Holy Roman of the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, this left the King of France, the most powerful king in Europe, France the most powerful nation, or really not a nation but a proto-nation, an incipient nation beginning to be a nation, and the French. Remember, I've already said that the Church was always more French than it was Roman. The French never really did like the idea of an Italian bishop running things, and the Pope never really did, at least had up to this time, never really has had authority in France like he has other places. Well, what happened was, you recall that Philip sent a man to kidnap the Pope? Philip, you recall Philip of France, he had... Uh, taken over church property to fight his wars, many with England. And when the Pope, when the papal envoy came to call him to task on that, he had the papal envoy arrested. Boniface VIII, the Pope, issued his famous Unum Sanctum with bull, which we read last week. Now, and so Philip has the Pope kidnapped, and he dies. Boniface VIII dies. Clement V, who was the successor to Boniface VIII, was helpless when he moved against the Knights Templar, and de Molay was executed. This brings us to the Babylonian captivity of the church. Philip compelled the papacy simply because it just had power and money. The papacy was having a hard time balancing its budget, and much of the money was coming from France. But Philip just simply moved the papal headquarters from Rome to Avignon. Now, Avignon is right here. It is on this side of the of the Rhone River. It is at that time Avignon was a French protectorate or a French possession within what we would call Italy. Got that? It was kind of an outpost, French outpost. It was not in France proper. See this? This time? I point to this, the boundaries have changed up here. This time, Avignon is here in the yellow section, the Holy Roman Empire. So it was not in France, so people could, it wasn't like you moved it to Paris, but Avignon was a French possession under French control and under the feudal system. So, from 1305 to 1378, the church, the popes, the papacy was not in Rome, it was in Avignon. And all the popes from this point on were French popes who were simply puppets of the French king, and everybody knew it. First of all, I indicate that in this period, the popes, who were Frenchmen, used their political influence on behalf of France against the kings of Germany and England. The church became something like a bureau France, of the French government, the French king. And he begins to be recognized as a political pawn rather than a moral power. You see that? It just becomes clear to everybody that the papacy is no longer a moral power. Does not represent who does the Pope represent? Well, what the Germans and the English were saying was, who were vying with France for national supremacy, they were saying, well, things like this. Well, it's obvious. Just look at what's happening. The Pope is on French territory. It's away from Rome. The papacy is away from Rome. He's a flunky of the French king. Therefore, the Pope is not the vicar of Christ. Does not represent Jesus. Is not a moral force. The Pope simply represents the king of France. And there was a lot of grounds for saying that. As a consequence of this bold face political activity, there arose a lot of significant criticism of the papacy. And note this, it was not simply, we're going to see, this is very important, what began as criticism of how the papacy was functioning, that is, as a sort of an extension of the French government. But they did not stop there. This is very important, that they began to have important scholars and thinkers questioning not simply the way the papacy was being handled, but the very theory of the papacy, as set forth by Gregory VII, as claimed by Innocent III, executed by Innocent III to a great degree. Y'all see that? Two different issues. The very theory of the papacy was questioned. For instance, and we're going to see these again, I mentioned them here, Dante, you studied in your Christian literature class, William of Ockham, John of Paris, they began to oppose the temporal claims of the papacy. That is, they were saying questioning whether the Pope had authority over temporal matters, over kings. They began to say what Martin Luther was to say later: the Pope wants to be the head of the Roman Church, let him, but if he wants to be the head of Germans, no, of German kings, then no. They were questioning his temporal power. Marsiglius of Padua, who was the rector of the University of Paris, which was a very important intellectual center, perhaps the greatest of the time, is sometimes called the first modern man in Europe. They don't get excited about that. There's about 16 men who are called the first modern man. Petrarch's one of them, and we're going to look at two or three others. But some call Marsiglius of Padua the first modern man, as opposed to medieval man, because he argued that the supreme authority is not in the papacy, but in the New Testament. Anybody's a guy way back then saying that. And that the power of both church and state is in the hands of the people. He didn't say that you can't have a pope, but he said that both pope and king are to hold power for the people, and they retain it only so long as they use it for its intended purpose. And by the way, we're going to see this idea coming to the fore again in next quarter when we look at a phenomenon called covenant theology. Same kind of thinking, and we won't pursue it here. That is, God, according to Marsiglius, gave the Pope to the church, not the church to the Pope. The tail was wagging the dog, he said. And he said it is not the Pope who has authority over the church, it is the church who has authority over the Pope, and this, of course, is the famous conciliar theory. Well, the theory, the basic, maybe we talked about this before, who's in charge? The council, like Nicaea and the Council of Ephesus, do they have authority over the Pope, or does the Pope have authority over councils? Well, you can see why it is, we are not surprised, let me put it this way, we are not surprised to find scholars like Marsiglius of Padua questioning the very theory of the papacy when we understand that when he's writing this, the papacy is simply a pawn of the French king. And so there's a move on, not to destroy the papacy, but to make it subject to councils so that the Pope cannot act unilaterally on behalf of France. The Pope simply can't promote the French cause. He's subject to review himself. You see that? Question. Yes. Not then, but the papacy, Marsiglius isn't getting a good deal of trouble. Then nobody liked it. Later on, people would be put to death for saying this. But the papacy was too weak. This papacy was weakened. You can see how the papacy, where you have Innocent III telling kings what they can and cannot do, and now you've got the Pope's not even in Rome anymore. He's a Frenchman who's subject to the French king, who does exactly what the French king says. He's too, couldn't do much about it, just weakened. The papacy is weakened. Didn't like it, he could have excommunicated him or something. But keep in mind, this idea of papal infallibility was not yet dogma still. We'll keep coming back to this. Scott's good question. Here he raises this. It's interesting that the very concept of the papacy that Marsiglius objected to and that Martin Luther objected to, we're going to see next quarter. It's a little bit different. You see, it was not hard and fast and legal as it is now. The hard, fast doctrine of absolute authority and absolute infallibility of the papacy, which exists now in the books, was being taught and practiced and assumed, but it was not fully codified yet. That is, technically, he was not violating church dogma. He was violating the claims made by the papacy. But keep in mind, you see, there's this long gap. And many of these claims that were made by the papacy, listen to me, many of the claims made by the papacy were not codified, were not put on the books, not made legal, until after the Protestant Reformation began. And infallibility, 1870. And it was done in response to the Protestants who were objecting to the claims. And again, let me look ahead, let's survey the landscape again, as I keep saying, because it's a good question. You see, we're going to see this again with the Protestants. How can they say this, you see? But to understand that many of these hard and fast dogmas of the Roman Church, they were not dogmas, not all of them, they were not dogmas during the Protestant Reformation. They were being claimed, practiced, taught by the Church, but they were not officially the doctrine of the Church. And the Roman Church was hurt by the fact that such men as Martin Luther and Erasmus and Marsiglius and others could say, now wait a minute, you accuse us of heresy? You show me where it says that. You are claiming it. And so Many times the Protestant reformers could go back and defend themselves by saying, it is we who are teaching dogma, you are teaching innovation. You are teaching that which is claimed and practiced, but has never been officially dogmatized. And so what happened was, the Roman Catholic Church, many of these things that they were objecting to, dogmatized them after the fact. Simply said, okay, since you say it's not really dogma, we'll show you, we'll make it dogma. I'll give an example of this. The books in the Apocrypha, they were not officially in the Old Testament when Martin Luther and the other reformers objected to them. The church was using them, considered them the Word of God, but they had a hard time explaining the fact that when the reformers came along, they said they're not the Word of God, these apocryphal books. And the church has never said they were. And so the church, in effect, says, we'll fix that. They said they were. Following? But these books were officially included in the Apocrypha as a response to the Reformation. Do you see that? So my basic answer to you, Scott, is that the issues were cloudy. Some of these claims were made. See, for instance, the farther north you go, the fewer these claims that are accepted. You get into Scottish Christianity and Irish Christianity. And the east, some of them were never accepted. And in France, they'd never been really accepted. It's sort of been lip service paid to them. So it was not a matter of a clear-cut system being opposed by men who were obviously rebels. Well, those issues are that way now, but these issues became clear-cut as a result of the struggle. They were not that clear-cut before the struggle. Does that help you? So it helps if you see that, you can understand why men like Erasmus was one of the things we're going to see next quarter is that Erasmus was more Protestant than Martin Luther. That is, if you look at what Erasmus taught, his doctrines were more radically anti-Catholic than what Luther taught. Luther was a heretic. Erasmus died a Roman Catholic in the good graces of the church. Why? Well, Erasmus picked his issues clearly. He stayed in the cloudy areas. And there are other reasons. Erasmus worked from within, Luther from without. But the issues were not all that clear. So a man could say this, and whether he get away with it or not, whether he would lose his life saying it, depended upon the local situation. And in this case, the Pope was simply not able to, he was saying this in Paris. And the last thing that a Pope could do was to run things in France. Because the Pope was simply a flunky of the French king now anyway. Does that help you? It's very, very complicated. But if you see how cloudy these issues were and how local, how much it depended upon just who was in charge and the local situations, it'll help you to see why. Because it's very, very confusing. How come he didn't get in trouble with this, you see? Question? Yes, the University of Paris, the king was proud of the University of Paris. He was proud of these scholars, just like we're going to see Frederick the Wise was proud of Martin Luther. And if he wanted to question it, he was protected. It was taken seriously. It wasn't taken as doctrine. So he was a part of a strong movement to restore the authority of the council over the Pope. Because the Pope was making his individual claims, he could speak unilaterally. And Innocent III had created a lot of this, you see. Now, especially, you do not want not even Frenchmen, but let alone Englishmen and Germans, wanting a man. Here's a Frenchman who's in Avignon, who does exactly what the French king tells him to, or almost exactly. This man, is he going to have absolute authority over, in some cases, three-fifths of our land and wealth? Get to understand, see, the church owns the real estate. Owned as much as two-fifths, perhaps three-fifths of England at this time. Now think about this. Suppose you're the English king. And what's your number one enemy? France. And here's the Frenchman who's the Pope in French territory, not even in Rome, who is claiming absolute authority, absolute ownership of over half of your wealth. And then you follow it, same thing with the Holy Roman Empire, Germany. You see that? Well, it's pretty hard to have an independent nation. Nations are growing now. if a foreign dictator claims and actually has direct control, unilateral authority over as much as a third to over half of your wealth and important ecclesiastical offices. You can see that. Why when Marsigulus Scott would come along and say, well, this man doesn't really have all that authority, it has to go through the councils, there would be a lot of support for that, saying yes. Well, it did grow. William of Ockham denied papal infallibility, but keep in mind, that was not a dogma. It was being claimed, but not, it was not being recognized by some people, but it was not on the books. He argued that the general council, not the pope, was the highest authority. Okay? Now, I've already given you your six popes to be remembered. Look, I've looked at that. Let's go on now to our discussion 29. We're getting behind. But I want us to see what's going on. It's very important. I'm going to move very quickly now. In this period, the German princes adopted the famous Declaration of Ross. Keep in mind, what was their reaction? Here's this Frenchman, this French pope. At Ross, German princes, not all of them, but most of them, drew up this famous Declaration of Ross, 1338, stating that the Holy Roman Empire had the right to elect its own emperors without papal interference, as he had done before, as Innocent III had done, certainly interfered. They rebelled against being manipulated by a French pope who was under the direct influence of the King of France. Now, this didn't stop the pope from interfering, but they got together and agreed he didn't have that right. Trouble is brewing. In England, I give you the years, 1351, 1353, provisos were drawn up declaring that the English church had the right to elect its own bishops without interference from Rome or Avignon, and limiting the right of appeal from English civil courts to Roman ecclesiastical courts. If you get a crook or a murderer, and he's a part of the clergy, and he's found guilty in an English court, that settles it, doesn't have the right to appeal to a Roman ecclesiastical court. And in this period, the financial activity of the church came to a climax. The drain of gold to Rome was a serious problem to emerging national states. Keep in mind, land was the primary source of wealth, almost the only source of wealth. The church owned much of this. Where was the gold going? Listen to me. It's simple as this. Don't make this harder. You've got emerging nations. You've got competition. You've got conflicting feudal claims. You have English nobility who, through marriages and descendants, claim much of England. You've got English nobility claiming much of France. And you've got England claiming much of the Holy Roman Empire. It's sort of a squatter's rights. Possession was nine-tenths of the law. There were conflicting feudal claims to this land. And so, what do you do? The answer is, you fight. Now you have Germans fighting and Frenchmen and English, and people begin to think in those terms. Not just part of Christendom, but I'm a Frenchman, I'm an Englishman, I'm a German. Now listen, you're going to fight. Note this, as simple as this, if you're going to have a strong nation, if you're going to put together a nation out of a feudal system, you've got to enforce your claims to the real estate. Got that? If you're going to do that, you've got to fight. If you're going to fight, it takes money, it takes gold. So here they needed to fight to establish their national claims. They needed gold. But what if the church owns as much as half or more than half of the gold? That the gold, the hard cash, is going where? You can imagine how hard it would be if the hard cash was going to Rome and being wasted there. We're going to talk about that in a minute. This was a real problem. And the church was draining gold out of the world in a way that you wouldn't believe. I just list here some of the oppressive measures used by the church to gain income. You ready? I'm talking about, okay, first of all, taxes from the papal states. Remember we talked about the fact that when Pepin conquered the Lombards, he gave all this land to the pope, he became a feudal lord. So first, they had their own lands. Then there were annates. The first year's income from a newly appointed bishop. They'd appoint a bishop to an office, first year's income went to the pope. Talk about, it's like a hiring agency. You know, you get the first month or first 2 months pay for the job. And so, of course, a lot of And that was a lot of money. Got that? It's called annate, means it's 1 year's salary. Tithes, that is 1/10 of the income from ecclesiastical offices as the need arose. For instance, the Pope, he would appoint a bishop, but the bishop would have to send his first year's income back to the Pope, and then if the Pope claimed it, 1/10 of that income every year following. Are you with me now? Then there was called service charges, revenues from such services, ordination, confirmation of a bishop. When he was confirmed in office, that was a separate charge. Pay. Well, the bishop, so here's a bishop, he wants to be a bishop. And by the way, they could get rich being a bishop. Very corrupt system. Give the first year's income to the Pope, then at least 1/10 every year after that, plus you got to pay him to ordain you, and pay him to install you in office. Then there was the pallium, which the bishop had to wear, this mantle showing his authority, had to pay for that, huge sum of money. It's like buying a car and then buying the tires, you know, then buying the seats. You see that? Then there was visitation. High officers were expected to go to Rome once a year. Now they had to pay for their entertainment. Well, they had to come and pay the Pope to entertain. And it came to be that they had to pay the fee whether they went or not. The Pope charged them. You know what it would cost to entertain them. So if you can't come, that's your problem. I've been counting on the money. So they had to send the money if they didn't go. Then there was procuration. A portion of the fees paid when priests visited bishops went to Rome. That is, the bishops had the same system. The priests had to come and visit the bishop once a year and had to pay for their keep and then had to send the money. It was always more than it actually cost. But had to send the money if they couldn't come to visit the bishop. So this money that they sent, even if they couldn't come to visit the bishop, part of that had to go to Rome as a procuration fee. Then there were spoils. If a Christian died intestate, his property was supposed to belong to the Pope. Die without a will. You know what intestate means? You die without a will. If you die without a will, everything went to the church. Then there were vacancies. If a bishop or an abbot died, a Pope would delay the appointment of a successor and claim the income in the office, from the office in the interlude. Now, an abbot, they have the head of a monastery. You got that? Here's this so much income coming every year to this bishop's office or this head of a monastery, head of an order. And he dies. Well, the Pope might wait six or 8 months, sometimes a year or two, sometimes even more, before appointing a successor. There's nobody doing the job. Well, but the income keeps coming in. Who gets it? The Pope gets it. There was Peter's pence. This is a penny per person. Tax paid by kings and princes to indicate feudal dependence. That is, a head tax. And fealty to the Pope, and it sent a penny per person per year. Which is quite by the way, a penny was quite a chunk of money. A penny was a day's wages. Follow me, it wasn't like one of our pennies. Follow me? A day's wages per person in your per year in your whole kingdom. A lot of money. Then there was the apostolic tax, a tax levied upon certain nations and certain monasteries. We'll go into that. There was charitative subsidies, that is, special appeals on the basis of charity made to bishops and abbots in times of special need. And often, the Pope would claim a special tax, especially to send a chunk of money. For this year, we get a special need, special call, you know. But then he said, well, you sent it last year. No reason why you shouldn't send it next year, even if the need no longer exists. Well, those came to be, even these charitative special calls, these charitative subsidies, came to be regular donations. Then there were indulgences, and we're going to talk about those later. Huge, very important source of income, huge amounts of money. Then there were absolutions. Excommunicants paid money as a part of their being restored to the church, which led them to excommunicate a lot of people. They'd excommunicate people on any pretext. Why? They had to pay a lot of money to get back in, so they'd go to heaven. Then there were dispensations. That is, if you wanted to do something that wasn't quite right, or had done something that was wrong and wanted to make it right, you had to pay for it. The Pope, through the bishop, would give a special dispensation. For priests born out of wedlock, that is, you weren't supposed to have a priest who was illegitimate, but you could pay a dispensation, he could take office. Prelates who wished to absent themselves from their livings. The bishop didn't want to live in his diocese. He'd pay the Pope so much, of his income, and he would get the rest of it and wouldn't even have to live there, wouldn't do any work. Persons wishing ordination before they were of age. Here's a man, a rich boy, a boy's rich daddy wanted to buy him a church office so he could take care of him, but he was underage, so 8 years old. A little bit young to be a priest or a bishop. So they would pay a dispensation and have him ordained, even though he was too young. Are you with me now? Clergy who said Mass in interdicted territories. The Pope would have put an interdiction on, and people get their money together and their clergyman could say the Mass, but he had to pay a dispensation to it for it. Relatives wishing to marry. That is beyond second cousins. They wanted to marry. However, the church, this is quite a thing. The Pope really, the Roman Church really had a thing going here. You could not marry a relative. But they made this, they extended this to the seventh degree. That is, a relative was anything like a fifth or sixth cousin. Well, you can imagine, in some of those feudal communities, where people sort of stayed in the same area and there was a lot of marrying, people didn't travel a lot, you'd be related, finally, in many of those areas, if you push relatives to the seventh degree, you'd be married, you'd be related to everybody. I mean, you're a fifth or sixth or a second cousin. I mean, our seventh cousin, you know. And then they extended this to godparents, non-relatives who stood in for you at your baptism. And then all of their relatives were just like they were your blood relatives. So you had four sets of parents, you know, your regular parents, your godparents, and then their cousins were your cousins. And so when the church tied it up that you really had to scrounge around to find somebody that you weren't technically related to. So that almost every marriage in that day required a dispensation because the priest would find that you were either through your regular parents or through your godparents, you were related in some way, as the church defined relation. And they did this because it was more money. Follow me? So it was the exception to have a marriage that did not require dispensation. Can you see why it would? Okay, that's quite a racket. Princes who wanted to exercise the right of coinage, they wanted to coin money, could pay a dispensation. The king who wanted to carry a sword on Christmas Day could if he'd pay for it. Kings who wanted to legitimize bastard children, they had a lot of them. A dispensation. A sick nun who wanted to leave a convent to go home, she could. She would be breaking her vow, technically. But she's sick. She could pay a dispensation to go home. A converted Jew who wanted to visit his unconverted parents had to pay for it. By the way, in each of these cases, they would get a little slip of paper, a little signed slip of paper, a little certificate showing that they had permission to do, they had paid to do this. And I'm just sampling. I just sampled this for us here. The permission to hold more than one benefice to secure freedom, one benefice. That is, if a bishop wanted to hold two dioceses for the income, pay a dispensation. It was a big dispensation for that. To secure freedom from fasting on Friday. Somebody invites you out and they're not very religious and they cook a big old roast beef and it's Friday and you know it. And if you got the money, you just get dispensation and you don't have to observe the fasting, even during Lent. To permit a city to establish a school. If a city wanted to establish a school, it had to pay the Pope. A layman to hear a university lecture on law and physics had to pay the Pope. That was supposed to be just for the churchmen. To permit a city to erect a hospital. To receive stolen goods. if you're a pawn shop owner, the pawn shop started back then, and you wanted to receive stolen goods, okay, as long as you paid the dispensation to the Pope for it. And on and on and on. There were the sale of offices. Papal offices had a great under-the-table income, as I point out here. They were sold by the Pope. Often the applicant would pay 10 times the annual above-the-table income. What would a man do if he paid 10 times the annual income just to get the office? What was he going to do as soon as he got the office? Yeah, he's going to get his money back. How? Same system. Kind of gives you the picture of a corrupt church, doesn't it? And they wanted money. By the way, what did they want this money for? It wasn't so bad that the church was going to all these lengths to get money. And can you not see how this would drain the capital, the liquid assets of a nation? when all the people, follow me, it's not just the church owning so much of the land and the products of the land going to Rome, but everybody who lived anywhere. I mean, if you wanted to do anything, just about, you had to pay cash on the barrelhead. Well, can you not see? Does this help you understand why Henry VIII would stop it and the King of France would stop it? Why all of they can't? You can't have a nation. You can't get any. It would just destroy your economy. By the way, it's kind of like America now. One of our real problems is our foreign exchange and the fact that so much of our ready cash goes to the Middle East. This destroys our economy. I hear just a flow of gold. Anybody extra cash. Well, the king couldn't tax them. The king could put a tax on to raise money to fight his wars, to build his nation. But if it didn't do any good, a lot of people didn't have any money. Where'd it all gone? Italy. You see. And the church saw to it that the people just, if they had any cash, a lot of local priests, if the people had any, if he heard about it, and by the way, he could find out who had cash, how? The confessional. You just ask him, he had to tell him. And so he'd figure out something they did wrong. And this was a very immoral age. You didn't have to look very far. People did things wrong all the time. People lived in all kinds of sin. So he'd say, well, you owe a dispensation for that. You got to pay a penalty. You owe some indulgence money. And so does it help you understand why these kings would just simply stop this? We can't have this. And then, to make matters worse, there was the prodigal expenditure of money. If they were using the money well, it'd be different. But you see, the popes during this period at Avignon often had the most luxurious and most licentious courts in Europe. The papal palace at Avignon stands today as one of the greatest works of art in the history in the world. And you still see it. I mean, they were living in wealth and splendor and had their harems. And much of the money was spent on wars waged by the papacy. So here you had the money drain, the common people being impoverished, and the popes were multimillionaires. They controlled so much money, and we're going to see later that they were patrons of the arts rather than of the soul. Well, that didn't help matters. Can you see that? I mean, if that money was going to care for the poor, to do mission work, and it would have been a little bit different, but it wasn't.
Is that why the Roman Catholic Church is so wealthy now? Why they have so much money?
Well, they have a lot of gold. One of the reasons, yes. Although a lot has changed.
They still collect money now,
though. Sure they do. But can you imagine how you would feel if you were an ordinary person? Maybe you'd committed adultery? Maybe you had a woman that you couldn't afford to marry, or for whatever reason, and you commit something, you know, so you had to pay a dispensation and to the Pope. What was he doing with your money? He was keeping a harem, and everybody knew it. He wasn't even trying to hide it. You know, so here I am committing fornication, and I got to pay a dispensation to him to finance his fornication. Well, a little bit of that goes a long way. And so I'm telling you about this because we're going to see when the Reformation broke out, there was a lot of people had a lot of reasons and a lot of good reasons to reject the authority of the papacy. Well, but now what they're trying to do is to take away that authority by asserting conciliar authority. Then came the famous Great Schism. Let me go through this very quickly. The Great Schism began when Gregory the 11th, he was a Avignon Pope, the last of the Avignon Popes. Well, before the schism, I give you the years, 1378 to 1417. This is the end of the Babylonian captivity. You follow me? You go from the captivity to the Great Schism. What happened was, Gregory the 11th, who was in Avignon, made a pilgrimage to Rome, and while he was there, he died. And the people in Rome, who traditionally had elected the Pope, they simply held an election to replace him. The College of Cardinals met there, and under the pressure of the mob, they elected a Roman pope. Up to now, for several years, they had been French. By the way, it's called the Babylonian captivity of the church because it lasted approximately 70 years. Hence the Babylonian captivity. Urban VI. Well, Urban VI stayed in Rome, and he was an arrogant and ascetic reformer. Whereas the Avignon popes, the French popes, had been luxury-loving Renaissance men, patrons of the arts. This old boy was strictly business, and he ruled with an iron hand. He was an ascetic, whereas these fellows were very licentious and gluttons, many of them, wasteful, not him. And he was a reformer. From that point of view, he was a good man. But he was even the cardinals. In fact, he was just too hard, and everybody began to object. So the cardinal said, well, we were forced to elect him under pressure of the mob, which was true. That was not a lie. And so Urban the Sixth, so they proceeded to invalidate the election to get somebody who was a little more acceptable. Plus, they had the French breathing down their necks. So they elected another Frenchman, Clement the Seventh. The problem was that Urban the Sixth, reigning in Rome, didn't recognize the disendowment. He recognized his election, but when they elected a successor, the College of Cardinals, he simply said, no, I'm still the Pope. So now you had the first of the schism. You had Urban the Sixth reigning in Rome and Clement the Seventh in Avignon. And Europe divided. You can imagine, you can see why they would. Here's a good excuse. They didn't like this idea of a French Pope anyway on French territory. So here gave them, Urban particularly, but at least they had now somebody they could sort of hang their cause on and say and oppose. They could use him as a justification for opposing the French Pope. Well, then it got complicated. The church said, we can't have this, so neither Pope would trust the other enough to resign first. The church leaders said, we can't have this, let both of them resign. So the Urban said, I'll resign if Clement will, and Clement said, I'll resign if you will. But both of them knew that as soon as they resigned, the other one declared himself the sole pope, which they would have, probably. So they couldn't, that wouldn't work. And so finally, the conciliar theory, which was gaining steam, came to the fore. Obviously, if you ever needed to assert the authority of the council over the papacy, it was now. I mean, it's bad to have an immoral pope, right? That's bad. And you might want to have the councils over him. It's bad to have a pope like Innocent III who meddles in political affairs too much. It's bad to have the pope as a puppet of the French king. That's bad. And we ought to have a council. But now we've really got to have the councils over the popes. Why? Because as bad as those things were, now we've got two popes. And the one thing you can't have is two popes. So the church cardinals got together and they called a council, met at Pisa, so they would have plenty to eat. At Pisa, the leaning tower of Pisa in northern Italy. They met at Pisa, a neutral territory, so they didn't meet in Avignon, couldn't meet in Rome, so they met in the third territory. 1409, they met and voted and called on both the Avignon and the Roman cardinals. I was called by both the Avignon and the Roman cardinals. By the way, he had two sets of cardinals. As soon as the cardinals elected Clement at Avignon, Urban in Rome simply appointed another college of cardinals. So not only had two popes, she had two sets of cardinals. So both of those cardinals, who had more sense than their popes, they got together and called a council at Pisa. You got that? They called the council at Pisa, and they called on both Urban and Clement to resign, both the Avignon and Roman cardinals to resign. Clement's dead now. It's Benedict. You can look at the summary. We're going to trace it now by the lines, not the men. The Avignon papacy, you're going to see the Pisan papacy and the Roman papacy. But anyway, it recognized that the church needed reform in two areas, administrative reform and moral reform. Talk about all this money-raising schemes. So what the Council of Pisa did, it deposed both popes and elected Alexander V as the pope and went home. No more reform, no more moral reform. What happened? Well, neither pope, the one in Rome or the one in Avignon, recognized the Pisan Council. And now how many popes did you have? Now you got three. You got a Roman pope, an Avignon pope, and a Pisan pope. Follow me? Who was elected by a meeting of the Avignon and the Roman councils. This is what you call a mess. And so, it was recognized by the Roman church now, But not back then. They just simply said, no, I'm Pope. Well, you, but if you want to know the succession, if I would look in the back of your in your syllabus, and it traces the official succession, so you can look at it later and see which one they trace. Well, this came, then came the famous Council of Constance. We're going to look at this again. Famous Council of Constance, 1414 to 1418, the high point of the conciliar movement. It was called by the German king for the purpose of dealing with reform, not just administrative reform. You got too many popes, too many, but also moral reform. And also a problem being raised that which takes us into the next quarter, and that is a man called John Huss, one of the pre-reformers who's starting to